As 9 new senators and 93 new members of the House were sworn into the U.S. Congress earlier this month, there are questions about how the Democratic and Republican parties have evolved and what party loyalty means to upcoming debates. In their new book, Responsible Parties: Saving Democracy from Itself, electoral expert Francis Rosenbluth and political theorist Ian Shapiro argue that devolving power to the grassroots is not the solution, it is part of the problem. Efforts to decentralize political decision-making have made governments and especially political parties less effective and less able to address constituent concerns. They are the authors of the new book, Responsible Parties: Saving Democracy from Itself. Ian Shapiro joins us this morning. He is Sterling Professor of Political Science at Yale University. Professor Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this project and ultimately looking at the responsible parties?
What brought us to this project is the fury of voters at dysfunctional government, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. We wanted to both explain why this is happening and what to do about it. The biggest symptom of the phenomenon, I think, is that while everybody complains about polarization in Congress, the congressional parties are much more polarized than the American voter. And so one question is, well, why is that? And the short answer is primaries, because the dirty little secret about primaries is that they have very low turnout, and they tend to have turnout from the extremes of the parties. So you'll get someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected in New York, or Jim Jordan of the Freedom Caucus Tea Party elected in Ohio. When these people get to Washington, what happens is either they compromise on what the small numbers of Ocasio-Cortez was elected in an 11% turnout. So either they compromise on the people who've sent them there, in which case they accuse them of selling out, or they don't, in which case everybody else complains about gridlock. That is a big part of the problem that weakens the parties. And we have a series of proposals about how to counteract that and strengthen them.
Before we get into some of those proposals, do you believe the two-party system is good just for the two parties, or does it make way for other parties?
I know single-member district systems will always produce two parties so long as the political shape of constituencies is more or less like the political shape of the country. If you have single-member district systems, as we have in most of the U.S., you're going to end up with two parties. We don't think the problem is the two parties. It's rather that the problem is the weak parties. It's that the parties cannot actually govern. And this, by the way, in other parts of our book deal with France and Germany and Italy and Spain and many countries that have multi-party systems, they have exactly the same problems now because they also have weakened their parties. So it's a sort of attractive nuisance to focus on more parties, and instead we really think the problem is focusing on parties that can actually make decisions and govern when they're in power, and that's what weak parties cannot do, whether you have two or many.
So as you point out in the book, when parties are divided, members don't agree on anything. They don't agree on policy, and certainly anything that could negatively impact the next election. Since it is now all about getting elected again, or for the first time, how do you change that?
The reason it's got so much worse in the U.S. is not just primaries. We've had primaries since the early 20th century. But what's happened in the U.S. is that the vast majority of our seats are now safe seats. More than 90% of the seats are safe seats. So the only election that actually matters is the primary. And you have this, as I said, this extremely low turnout of people who are not remotely representative, even of the voters in their parties, never mind at the country. And so one way or another, what needs to happen is to blunt that influence. And so there are things that could be done. Like, for example, most Americans don't know how low the turnout is in primaries. So you could easily imagine a rule where if the turnout in a primary was below 75% of the previous general election, it would be disregarded and the congressional party would pick the candidate. Because the congressional leadership has an incentive to pick people who can both win in their district and support a national program. So they're looking, you know, they need to win a majority, so they need people who can win in their districts. But they also need people who can support a set of policies that they can actually implement. So that's one thing we could do. And at the presidential level, the same thing. People forget that, or never knew, that Trump was picked as the Republican candidate by less than 5% of the U.S. electorate. Again, a very unrepresentative 5%. But then he's a candidate. If there's a weak candidate on the other side, he ends up president. So again, one could say if the turnout was down, then we would go back to the system that actually prevailed until Andrew Jackson attacked it. It's the first populist attack on American politics because he didn't like they used to have a system where the congressional parties picked the presidential candidates. He didn't like it because John Quincy Adams got picked over him in 1824. But we could go back to that, and it would make the U.S. system more like a parliamentary system. The president and the Congress, congressional party, would be on the same team. Pulling in the same direction, which is what we don't have now. So that's one reform we could make, which would empower the parties to pick people who could work together as teams.
This is anecdotal, certainly, but the rap on Democrats for decades has been that they fight with themselves and there is such internal division that they often, it becomes a circular firing squad. Although it seems as that's happening in some way, shape, or form in the Republican Party as well, and I guess my question is given what you're talking about and the system of the parties, that it sort of was inevitable that it was going to catch up to the Republicans as well as the Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. Politics is, you know, if you're looking at very big trends like this, it's really not about personalities or types of parties. What you have to look at is what system of incentives have we put in front of the politicians. It's not special to the Democrats. If you look at the Republican Party, where the Tea Party, which created the Freedom Caucus in Congress, you know, they elect somebody like first in John Boehner. He gets to be Speaker, and he makes the kind of compromise he has to make in order to govern. They then accuse him of selling out, but if he doesn't do that, then, you know, we have gridlock and everybody else is angry. Paul Ryan, the same thing. He was a darling of the Republican right. But when he actually had to exercise authority and get bills through Congress, they saw him as having, you know, turned into a rhino and so forth. It's really not about the people. It's about the rules. I don't think it's any different in the Democratic Party. So another thing that would blunt this is the process of drawing districts, which, as you probably know, is in most states done by the state legislatures. They, of course, then either draw them up to protect safe seats for their own party, whoever's dominant in the state legislature, or sometimes there's bipartisan agreement to carve up the state between the two parties. But in either of those cases, you get exactly the pathology we're talking about, because all the seats become safe seats. And the only election that matters is the primary. A much better way to go would be to go the way that some states have started to do, which is to appoint independent commissions to draw the districts and not have it be either a partisan thing or a bipartisan deal. And then the commissions should be instructed to draw the districts so that they'll be competitive across the parties, not within the parties. And then you'd get more genuine competition over the ideas that are actually going to be implemented if a party wins. At the end of the day, that's what produces accountability. If the party that wins has run on the platform that they're going to run on and then implements it, they can be held accountable for what happens or doesn't happen. What we have is incredibly decentralized system in which everybody can point fingers at one another and blame each other This will happen now, of course, with divided government again. No matter, you know, Trump will blame the House Democrats, and the House Democrats will blame the Senate and Trump, and the voters will be left there, you know, saying, well, you know, Washington's dysfunctional. So that's the kind of thing that we think is really at the bottom of this problem and has to be addressed.
So when you talk about it having to be addressed and being held accountable, when it comes to gerrymandering, obviously the courts get involved. And we've seen some in certain states where the courts have indeed gotten involved, although there has been quite a change in the face of the courts over the last 2 years as well. So is that a way of holding it accountable?
Until now, it hasn't been, because the Supreme Court has, you know, it is said in a couple of cases that there are circumstances in which partisan gerrymandering would be so extreme that they would intervene, but they have now actually done it. And so now, actually, the Supreme Court is again taking a couple of cases this term. So maybe they will revisit it. But the question is, what will the remedy be? And the remedy really should be taking this away from the state legislatures completely, because they have all the wrong incentives. You know, whoever's currently in charge is going to try and, if they have decisive control of the legislature and the governorship, they're going to do it to suit their own party. If they don't, they're going to do a bipartisan deal. Either one is bad for competitive elections. What we need is competition in the right places. We need competition between the parties over the ideas that they're going to implement if they win. That's the only way you get accountability. States like California have already gone to an independent commission. There are about 20 states actually that have some kind of commission. But unfortunately, most of them are bipartisan, which they sound good, but they're not really independent. They replicate the problem because they just make the deals. And that's not what we want. We want competitive districts so that the elections are actually about who's going to govern.
Ian Shapiro is our guest. He is co-author of the new book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It is published by Yale University Press, where Professor Shapiro is the Sterling Professor of Political Science. Let us talk about the inevitable, which is money. How much does money play into this, especially when you're talking about in the primaries, when, to use your statistic, turnout is about 10% of the American electorate. It is the most extreme 10% in both parties. So that money can buy you quite a lot, can it?
Yep. You know, it's another important point that we discuss at some length in our book. And the you know, everybody who talks about money talks about Citizens United and the problem of all these, you know, people with a lot of resources buying influence. And that, of course, is a huge problem. And it's a terrible thing. And it's, you know, it's actually a legacy going back to the 1970s when the Supreme Court first said that money is speech, which it isn't. It's money. But in any event, what we focus on is not that, but that's the supply of money. We focus on the demand side, and the point to notice is the reason politicians need so much money is that they're all running their own elections because the parties are so weak and the candidates are looking to survive in primaries, so they need a lot of money. If you look at countries like the UK, where the parties are much stronger, elections are way cheaper because, if you like, wholesale campaigning is much cheaper than retail campaigning. And so the parties are stronger. They campaign on a wholesale basis. Elections are much shorter if you don't have primaries, of course, as well. And so there's less demand for money. And if you could, you know, reduce the demand for money, then the supply of money would be somewhat less corrosive. So again, it's not a silver bullet. Our book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself, doesn't have silver bullets because there aren't, but what we offer is a variety of specific reforms that would improve things and stop pushing in the wrong direction, which is what we tend to do.
What is the motivation in both of the major parties to make the changes?
The motivation has to come from voters. I think that the problem with all political reform is that the current incumbents are benefiting from the current system, or they wouldn't be there. It's a system they all hate because A, they have to raise money all the time, and B, they can't govern because, as I said, either they cooperate, in which case the people who elect them accuse them of having sold out, or they don't, in which case everybody else is furious with the dysfunction and the gridlock and so forth. So it's like people who are trapped in a bad marriage, if you like. Mm. And, you know, what's needed and the reason we wrote our book is to try and get people to focus on the right issues. And the right issues are you can't have effective government without responsible parties. And we have created a world in which it's not possible for them to function as responsible parties. And that is what we need to address.
So in our final few minutes, I want to focus on something that you mentioned at the beginning, which is the reason I so wanted you on the program, because I find this to be one of the most important and interesting aspects of what we're going through, because it's not just what we're going through. As you have a chapter in this book entitled Creeping Authoritarianism in Eastern Europe. As you mentioned at the beginning, we're seeing this across the globe. We're seeing this not in this country. We're seeing this. So this is replicating itself again and again and again and again.
Absolutely.
And we almost have to solve it as a global problem, don't we?
Well, I don't think that's true, and there's no global we who can do that.
I guess what I'm saying is we have to have a global understanding of the problem, don't we?
Weak parties show up differently in different electoral systems. So in Germany, for example, they've now given the membership veto power on everything the leaderships do, and that has a similar effect to primaries because the voters who show up for those kinds of votes are like primary voters. They tend to be on the extremes of the parties. Or in the UK, for example, Jeremy Corbyn's way to the left of the median Labour voter in Britain, never mind the median voter. So they elected him directly, the membership, who tend to be on the extreme. The parliamentary party votes him in vote of no confidence by 172 to 40, and the membership re-elects him. So you now imagine if the Labour get into government, how they're going to possibly be able to govern, because the backbenchers cannot support his program and get re-elected in their districts. So it is happening everywhere, but you have to tackle it differently in different systems. What we need, to agree with you, we need a global understanding that decentralized control of political parties makes everything worse. Even though voters think that it's going to give them more power. It's like somebody who's unsteady on their skis thinking they should lean back on their skis and lean into the mountain when actually they have to lean forward on their skis and lean out of the mountain. That's what people need to understand, that we actually have to empower political parties to act and then hold them accountable at the ballot box for what they do and don't achieve, rather than think we can have retail control over every decision they make. That just produces inaction.
So let us end with this. Toward the end of the book, you write, "Our brief tour of modern democratic politics has not been encouraging, but it is not devoid of hope." So let us end on a hopeful note.
Well, that's why we've avoided... In the U.S. case, for example, we've avoided pushing things that would require constitutional amendments and so forth, because there's plenty of scope within the system to blunt the effects of primaries, to engage in redistricting, to achieve greater coordination between the presidential candidates and the congressional candidates and so on. So it's sort of, you know, baby steps before big steps, change the conversation, find reforms that can actually work at the margin, and then people would see them beginning to deliver better results, and they would be less alienated from their politics. So that's the message of responsible parties saving democracy from itself.
Is it a good time to be a political scientist, or are you one of the reasons that you write the book is that you're just sort of aghast at what's happening?
No, I think, well, we're aghast at what's happening, but I think we need to bring to bear what political scientists know about the way parties work to the public debate. The political scientists spend too much time talking to themselves.
Well, the book is fascinating. It is called Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. Francis McCall Rosenbluth and Ian Shapiro are the authors. Ian Shapiro has been our guest. He is the Sterling Professor of Political Science at Yale University. Again, the name of the book is Responsible Parties. Ian Shapiro, thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Shapiro is the co-author of the new book, Responsible Parties, Saving Democracy from Itself. It's published by Yale University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.